Okay, so my name is Rena Basser. I'm a historian. My area is Second Temple. I've been at Queen's University for a number of years, and I was at CHAT teaching in history there for a number of years. And since today is a day of history, we read in our keynotes about the ancient temple, the first temple, the second temple. We read about lots of other destructions in Europe, all kinds of destructions. So I wanted to talk about something historical. And what I want to do is take the famous story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who escapes from Yerushalayim during the time of the Second Temple. And it's a sort of a resurrection story where he pops out in front of the Roman emperor to be. And a number of things happen there. And one of the things he does is he predicts what's going to happen. And then he asks for certain concessions. I want to talk about those concessions. And I want to ask the one question that bothers me and bothers many people, including the Gemara itself, in Maseches Gittin and Rashi too, is, did he ask for too little or not? Was he politically acute or was he just meek? And that is a very big question. And so to respond to that question and query and concern throughout the ages, we have to go through a number of things that you'll need explanation on about Roman history. Okay, so I'm going to set the stage for the story. We're going to go over the story. My handout is mostly pictures. I know. Okay, I'm guilty. But I thought, we're tired. I just put the broad strokes on the paper, and then we'll describe it. Have a pen ready. Maybe you'll fill it in for yourselves if you don't know the story. The story is well known, but maybe you forgot some of the details along the years. So let me give you, I'm on number one, historic background. Okay, this is the stage of the story. It's 68 CE. The Jews are in trouble in Jerusalem. They've been conquered in the north of the city, in the Galil, by Vespasian, Aspasianus in Hebrew, Vespasian, and his legions, the 10th legion, the 3rd legion, other legions as well, because from 66 to 68, the Jews were revolting in a serious way and winning. Okay. Now, this Vespasian enters the country in 68 at the request of Nero, who's the 5th Roman emperor. Nero, we've all heard of Nero, burning of Rome while he's playing the fiddle, jumps into the flames, commits suicide in typical Roman fashion. What happened from 66 to 68 is not only were the Jews revolting, but so were the English, the Germans called Gauls, the North Africans. Everybody who was under the Roman Empire was in revolt. It was the fad. The Romans were terrified. They saw this as an epidemic, which it was. And they were afraid that if they don't shut down the spirit of revolt in Yehuda, in Judea, it's going to go further east. It's going to go to modern-day Iraq, called Parthia in those days. And that's what they were afraid of. And they had good reason to be afraid. Our friend, sort of, Vespasian Aspasianus, had already quelled revolts in Britain, Gaul, Germany, North Africa. He was a proven general. Okay? And that was important for him because Aspasianus was not part of the patrician nobility. He was more common, which was rare for Rome to make somebody eventually an emperor because that's what he was going to be. He was going to be the 9th Roman emperor. Not only when we get to our story in the Gemara and in Avoti Rabbi Natan and in Midrash Eicha, not only was he, Vespasian, a great general, but who was going to be the emperor, but at that time, as Nero committed suicide, 3 Roman emperors in 2 years occupied the throne. And you don't need to know the names. If you like names, Otho, Galba, Vitella, it doesn't matter. The 3 of these guys could not hold the throne. The armies revolted against them and didn't support them. that is important, important, important for us to know for this story. You cannot walk into the story thinking it just really without the setting the stage. Okay, so I think that's clear. The Roman Empire was in turmoil. And there, it always is when there's lots of change. You know, turnover, they talk about in companies, right? Turnover is always bad. Well, it goes the same for Rome and for the whole empire as it is. So you have to remember the turmoil that is. And the Jews, too, in 66 CE, when they revolted, also understood that turmoil too well, all too well. Unfortunately, in the end, it was their undoing, but at the beginning, they were doing well. Okay, so when Vespasian was sent to Eretz Yisrael, he was sent, which is the way most people go, is through the north, through the Galil. You very rarely went any other way, because if so, then you have to deal with Egypt and go the Egyptian way. There's not that many ways to go. And we know from the Navi, the danger always comes from the north, the north, the north, because that's the way in. And in the Bar Kokhba revolt later on, everybody knew there was going to be a war. Why? Because the Romans were building roads in the north. That's what they were doing for 3 years before 132 CE, before Bar Kokhba. They're building roads, building roads, building roads, building roads, you know, all of that stuff, measuring. That's what they did. And that meant for everybody that there's going to be a war, because of course chariots need roads. They can't go on dirt paths. They can't go on mountain paths. It's not a good fit for them. They must have roads. So roads are always the key to war. And by the way, we'll see that they did that too. All again in the north, all around Eretz Yisrael, all around Yerushalayim, building roads, building roads, building roads, which is always the death knell, and it's an obvious sign of revolt. What I want to do now is go over the story. I have it labeled 2, 3, 4, 5, just go over the main points of the story, and then talk about the big question, which is, did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai do us a favor? Or did he not do enough for us? And we'll have to decide. So the first things first. Number two, what happens like this in the story, and all the stories are basically the same in all the sources. The story is like this. It's 68 CE. The city is surrounded. It's in siege. It looks bad. There's various factions within the city. There's part of our Sinas Chinam that we have. Terrible factions that really were very opposed to each other. And the factions that held the city gates were called the Biryonim. And the Biryonim were Jews and did not want to have surrender with the Romans, nor did they want anybody else to have surrender. They didn't want little groups to go out and surrender, which they did anyways. And we're going to see one case. And the Jews were doing this all the time, surrendering, coming out, running out, because they didn't want to be in a besieged city. And they were under tremendous distress, famine, and so on. There's lots of stories of famine. So this is how the story starts. The Biryonim, which today, by the way, in modern Hebrew is bullies. When I taught the story, my Israelis said, "What bullies?" So they were kind of semi-terrorists, I guess. The Biryonim were guarding the city gates and wouldn't let anybody out. Okay? Fine. Now, despite those kind of rebels, there was also a group in the city that were moderates, that wanted to give in, that wanted to give up, that wanted at least to save themselves, that wanted surrender, ultimate surrender. And one of those people was our famous Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai plays a major role after Chorban Bayit Sheni, because he goes on in Yavne to develop all kinds of, he's in many, many, many areas of development of halacha for those times. And he was very sensitive to what the people needed after destruction. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is sitting in the city, and he's leading basically the moderate group, and he wants to get out. But he can't. He's hostage. He's held hostage. Everybody's held hostage. And they don't want to, and nobody can get out. So what does he do? I don't know if you remember the plan. It was a pretty good plan. He sent a secret message to the head of the Biryoni named Abba Sikra. Sikra also, by the way, is not really, it's his like nom de guerre, for instance, because Sikra is from Sikari, which is also a kind of a terrorist. So the I'm on number two. The secret meeting says, come to me secretly. Excellent. He comes, he meets with him, and he says, what do you want? He says, I want to get out of the city. So Abba Sikra said, I can't. Maybe I'm head, but they're not going to let me. I'm through. You can't just walk out of the city and surrender. You have to do it in some secret way. Think of a plan. Goes, all right, let's think. So they decided on the following plan. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was going to fake his own death. He was going to jump in a coffin and put in something putrid. They suggested some kind of smelling meat, some putrid smelling meat, in order to show that really a dead person is in this coffin. He was going to appear then and go and talk to Vespasian, the general, who was right outside of the city walls, encamped, watching the whole Yerushalayim, watching the siege. Okay? Sounds good. It actually almost worked. He had people come and pretend he was sick and visit him, the whole thing, the whole pretense. Finally, he dies, jumps in the coffin. The four main disciples carry him. They're pallbearers. They come to the city gates, and they say, of course, the Biryoni who are watching the gates say, we can't let you out. We have a coffin. Okay. The rule was, if you died, right, you had to be taken out. They didn't have dead people in the city. So they thought they could get out very easily. It's not a bad plan. Now, the Biryonim were suspect. They said, there's something wrong with this. I didn't get a death notice. Right? Being all cute. Fine. So he says, there's something wrong. They say, if he's really dead, let's stab him and see that he's really dead. All right. The pallbearers, right, the disciples of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai are terrified. They make up they just tell him, no, you really can't stab him, because if you do, then it'll be said that you stabbed a great Talmud Chacham, which Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, of course, was known at that time. So they refrained. Excellent. They held their guard. They let them out. I'm on number five. Next page. They let them out, and now you're going to have a royal audience. Okay. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and the pallbearers go to the camp, to the Roman camp. They then are let in, and they go see Vespasian, the general, who's responsible for Eretz Yisrael at that time. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai jumps out of the coffin, much to the shocked general and his men, and says, peace unto you, O emperor. In Hebrew, Shalom Aleichem. In Latin, which is what it's cited in some of the other sources, Viva Domine Imperator. It actually says that in transliterated Hebrew in some sources. He says, you're going to be emperor. Okay. This is a big problem. Obviously, Vespasian's not emperor. He's just a general. He's an important general, but he's not an emperor yet. So what gives? Now, first of all, you have to ask yourself before you go on, how did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai get into the camp? It's not possible. It's just not possible the way it's said here. It's simplistic. They're not giving you all the shades and the nuance that's necessary. And that's where a historian's going to come in and need to tell you a couple things about a Roman camp. I don't know if you ever saw pictures of Roman camps, but you have seen outlines of Roman camps, right? Top of Masada, you see two Roman camp outlines. You've been to England, you see Roman camp outlines. You've been to Hungary, you've seen Roman camp outlines. You have seen the rectangular, typical outlines of a Roman camp. Why have you seen that? Because a Roman camp was an amazing architectural, stunning piece of work. The Romans were good at engineering, and they were good in that too. The Roman camp was like this. It had a rectangle because it had a trench. In back of those trenches, the trench was often used as like a moat. In back of the trench were high walls. Can you imagine this is just a temporary camp? Were walls. The walls had towers. They had guards. They had little, you know, little slits like this that the guards could see and then put their arrows through. They had roads inside the camp itself. This was not just like, you know, Machanekites of something or other. This was significant. They had roads. They had tents. They had the general compound in the middle. They had guards all over the place. A Roman soldier was a soldier, does anybody know? 25 years he signed up. And he was not just a soldier, really. He was an engineer. They carried around many, many pounds of engineering tools on them because that's where they were trained. And that's what they were doing. They were great at building roads. They were great at building camps. And that's why when you're on the top of Masada and the guide points out there was a Roman camp and there was a Roman camp and you don't have to think too hard because you see it already. All these years in the dust and the sand, the outline is still there as it is, as I say, in England and in all the places where they went. So you see it because it's significant. They worked hard at these camps. So now you're going to tell me, with what I know about a Roman camp, and by the way, just a little highlight for those who love Josephus, the historian of the first century, the where we know the most about Roman camps, and in his book, he explains pages and pages about the strength of a Roman camp and how unified and effective it was, because that's what it was. That's where all the information comes from, by the way, about a Roman camp, mostly from that. And then the archaeologists can go back and find it in the actual soil. Okay, Roman camps. Now, you're going to tell me, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, a nothing, nobody, who knows, a surrendered person, an enemy, is going to just walk into the Roman camp, walk in the epicenter of all this, and speak and say, Viva Domine Imperator, just like that? Not on your life. And that's why if you want to be a historian of ancient sources, you have to read a couple of sources. So it says, not in the Gemara Nusach, not in the Gemara source, but in Avot de Rabbi Natan, it says there that he was one of the friends of the Caesars. He was a friend. And they knew he was a friend because the Romans had traitors themselves. The Romans had people who listened to the Jewish discussions. They were inside the walls themselves and threw arrows outside telling the generals what's going on. So they already knew about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and his plan. They knew the whole thing. They didn't tell anybody, but they knew he was coming. They knew to be prepared for him. They told their guards, expect a coffin, something like that. You know, expectus a coffinus. No, I don't know. My Latin is nothing. Expect a coffin. And please, let him in. And it may smell putrid. They even knew about that. Let him in and let him talk to us because we got to hear what he needs to say. Because this is an important guy. And it's worth it for us to know what he wants to say. Okay. So he was allowed in. I had to tell you that. Because otherwise you would ask me, how did he get into the compound? How did he, you know, it's not simple. We know it's not simple. Think about the story of Yehudit. Yehudit Hanukkah. Yehudit gets in also to the Greek camp, and she poses as a woman of the you-know-what, and she gets in, and it's not simple either. And she gets in also to the epicenter of the Greek camp, and Halifernes and the head and all that. These are not easy moments, and you have to know the historicity of these events. Okay, so he's in front of the general, the Aspasianos, Vespasian, and he predicts his rise to emperorhood. A nice illegal saying, if I ever heard one, right? And even as Vespasian said, "What are you calling me emperor? I'm not an emperor." It's true. We don't really have stability in our realm, but I'm not an emperor yet, so that's illegal. And then he says to him, "And if I was an emperor," in good like Jewish mother guilt, "why didn't you come sooner?" You know, like that. Okay, so fine. So therefore, Vespasian is wanting to kill him. This is heresy, and this is a traitor. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knows what he's doing, but he does it anyways. He says, "Just wait. Don't worry, something's going to happen that's going to show I'm right." Okay, let's read the end, number 6. After the two leaders spoke together in parables and interesting things, I'm not going into it, a royal messenger at that very moment came in and addressed Vespasian. "Arise, Caesar is dead, and the notables of Rome have decided to appoint you head of the state." The confusion in the camp was legion. That's my own little, okay. Vespasian was off to Rome, leaving his son Titus, to complete the capture of Yerushalayim. As the new emperor was about to leave, he had some trouble getting ready. He tried to put his boots on, but they seemed to have shrunk. He tried repeatedly, with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai still staring at him wisely and patiently. Vespasian looked up and asked, "What's the meaning of this?" And I'll finish it off. And it talks about boots. The emperor can't put on his boots, because it said that good news makes a person fat, okay? and so he can't put on his boots, and then he needs Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to tell him how to put on his boots, because he has to go. He has to go and accept his new position. He's got to run off to Rome. And so they talk about this and that. It doesn't matter. Last part, number 7. The new emperor was confused. Now, as he was about to go, what's he going to do? What should he do with this guy sitting here with the disciples? So what should he do? So this is the famous, famous thing. Tein liyavne v'chachameha. He says to him, "What do you want? What do you want, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? I'll give you anything. What do you want? Just tell me what you want." So he says, in the Gemara it says, "Grant me Yavna and its sages and the dynasty of Rabban Gamliel, and physicians to heal Rabbi Tzadok." Three things. Three things, okay? An important typical number in that world. Three things he asks for. That's it. No Yerushalayim. No get out of town. Take your son Titus with you. No how about leaving us. No come back next year. Nothing. Get out of here. Just give me Yavna. Yavna, a city near today, Yavne Yam, it was called then, in the Latin sources, Jamnia. It was on the water near Lod today. Okay? A small little place. So the question is, again, why that? Why not more? Why not something else? Why Yavne? What could you get from it? What could you possibly get out of it? That's all? That's the whole thing? You're a friend of Caesar. You're the famous Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. You have vision. You knew he was going to become emperor, and you were right. And he didn't kill you. So now you have all kinds of victories, and that's it. That's the whole thing. So what I want to do now is to try to answer that question in the next 15 minutes. We'll do it in 15 minutes. Is to answer that question. And to answer that question, we need to know a little more about Rome, and a little more about what was going on, and a little more about the background of this man and how it all fits in. Because actually, what he did was perfect, and what he did was very visionary and helpful, obviously, and he saved the Jews in his own way. And so I want to see why that is. First of all, Yavne. There's two words for Yavne that I can say. I wrote it down here on the bottom of that page. An internment camp. That's what it was. Yavne was a place for prisoners. That's all it was. What do I mean by that? And why is that important to know? So it's a place for prisoners. So what? Okay. Quick history. This is what the Romans did. When they captured cities, be it Jerusalem, be it Yodfat from Josephus, or be it all the other cities, the myriad of other cities that they captured, they had people. They had human cargo. What to do with them? What to do with them? And they have all kinds of surrendered people. What to do with all these people? This is always a problem in war. Okay. So, do you want to kill them? Not such a good option. Not so happy about that. Do you want to make them slaves? Sell them as slaves? Not a bad option. In fact, after, not this war, but the next war, Bar Kokhba, there was so many slaves in the marketplace, they were getting 2 for 1. It was such a good value for a Jewish slave. Oh, did I get a mitzvah today? You know, so that's what it was. It was very, 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 there was a glut on Jewish slaves. So you could sell your slaves. That was a good way to do it. But you had other problems because you also had nobility. And nobility has respect for other nobility, either Kohanim or people like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and his ilk, or other wealthy groups. And wealthy groups are not always sold as slaves. Not always. Sometimes they are. One of the keynotes that we did this morning talk about them. But not always. So the Romans themselves didn't know what to do with them. Okay. This was their policy. They would take them and they would settle them in a city. An internment camp city with guards all around, making sure they didn't leave. And everybody talks about this. Roman sources, which we have a number, and Jewish sources, which the main one is Josephus, other than the Gemara itself. We're going to get to Roman sources in a second. I read all the Roman sources on this. I don't know if you know these names, Suetonius, Tacitus, Dio Cassius, people like that, anything with an S. But anyway, the three main Roman guys do talk about all the Jewish cases, which we're going to see in a minute, but the main procedure for dealing with runaways, of which there were many, was internment camps. And let's read a source that I quoted for you from Josephus on the bottom where it says Yavne. And I cite from the wars. Vespasian went to Yavne and Ashdod, our Ashdod, and set up there a garrison and took with him, this is what's to be highlighted, a great multitude of the people who had surrendered themselves to him under a covenant. People are surrendering. The Romans don't know what to do. They make themselves garrison cities, otherwise known as, I'm calling them camps, set up their guards. And the people, notice the last word, it's important, made a brit with them, made some kind of pact. Meaning to say, the people, what is a brit? It's a contract, right? You get rights and you get rights and you give in, whatever. You each have something. Isn't that a contract? I don't know. So I think so. So the Romans said, you stay in the city and don't run away. And we will let you practice your Yiddishkeit in the way you're used to. We will let you wear tefillin. We will let you daven. We will let you learn Torah. We will let you wear tzitzit, which comes up in all these sources. We will let you do all this Jewish stuff. We will let you eat what you want, have your holidays, do all your things. Have brit milah that later on are all restricted, by the way. All restricted. But at present, in the garrison camp, we're going to let you do everything. Good. Josephus already tells us that. He tells us that very, very words. And all those parts in there are very important, and the last part especially. Under a covenant. You cannot miss those terms. You must underline, like, arrows, all the things you can do to to get it into your head, because it's going to be helpful to understand, give Niyazna and its sages, and yes, and we'll agree, and we made a covenant. Okay. Now, I have another source for you, in case you didn't believe me there. Vespasian went up against Lida and Yavne, and when both of them, next page, had been delivered into his hands, he settled there, notice, the worthy citizens from the cities that had surrendered to him earlier. He had other cities. He had citizens, worthy citizens. Wealthy people, important people, learned people. The rest of them, slaves. But for those ones, sorry, double standard, but that's what he did. We have to know that. We have to know that was their policy. It was a standard policy. And the last one, a man named Pacitus, General Pacitus, very, very brutal, same thing. At that time, he conquered Avel and places in Transjordan and other towns and privileges as far as the Dead Sea, settled in each those among the Jewish fugitives who were useful. Okay? I think I wrote something funny. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The end, you have to know who were useful. The Jewish fugitives who ran away from Jerusalem and other places who were useful. What does that mean? What does useful mean? Obviously moneyed. Obviously are going to help the Roman government and made some kind of pact. Good. Now you can believe me. I gave you three sources. Well, maybe you won't anyways, but if you want to, I gave you, and I could stand here all day and give you another 20. I just brought, I thought, the most helpful ones, the most pointed ones. So, wonderful. Okay. Now you know that Yavne is also one of those, is also a place to harbor fugitives, is also a place where it's known that those kinds of people will go. And that's why Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says it. He doesn't say it because, why not? Maybe it's a good idea. He knew that that was a place for them. That was a political move that he did that was clever. That was clever. And you have to see it that way. And when he says, Tein li Yavne v'chachamea, he says, give me Yavne to be there. Some sources say to have tzitzis, to have tefillin, everything, to be Jewish outwardly. What are tzitzis and tefillin after all? To be Jewish outwardly, not only in our hearts, but also to the rest of the world, to our fellow Jews. Let me go there. Let me be there. And he said, yes, fine. You're worthy. You're great. We know you already. You're a moderate. Go with your friends. Go with the people that you want to save. Is it good? Is it enough? I don't know. I don't know. But that's what he did. Okay. Next thing. I'm going to end off with this one. And this is very important too. The prophecy. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, as you recall, comes in front of Aspasianus and says to him that famous line, Viva Domine Imperator, Hail, O Emperor. Traitorous line. What's that about? What are you saying that for? Why can't you just go and say, remember me? I was a moderate. You know about me. Your soldiers know about me. Everybody knows about me. I'm well known. Don't kill me. Give me what you want, please. No, he says this. Why? Because this notion of predicting the next emperor was seen to be a sport. The whole Roman world didn't know who's going to be next. They didn't know where their Yeshua, Lahavdil, was going to come from. Who was going to take over the realm? And so what I listed for you here were five other places, main places, that other people also predicted that Vespasian was going to become emperor. And that's why Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai could do it too. Vespasian expected it. It was something already in the air. And remember, they're having lots of turmoil between 66 and 68 CE. Nothing is going well. Everyone's getting murdered and bumped off and whatever they did. Things are not going well for the Roman Empire. Everybody's in flames. Everybody's revolting. Everybody. It's not a healthy time. And therefore, Vespasian was nervous. And other people were nervous too. Who is going to do it? Who is going to help us? Vespasian was emperor for 11 years. He actually did a very good job. And he restored some of the turmoil and got rid of some of the turmoil that was plaguing the world. Okay, so let's go through quickly some of the other people who gave predictions about Vespasian and why this was typically normal and regular in this period, in this time for this man. Number one, Josephus, the famous first century historian who ends up in Rome, who writes in Greek, right, who was there at the time. He also predicted that Vespasian was going to become emperor. Granted, he predicted it like Lemma Freya when he was already sitting pretty in Rome, but that's not the point. The point is he puts in his mouth a prediction. Josephus was a general in the north. He held a city called Yodfat. They all got captured. It's a long story. It's not for now. All got captured. And Josephus got captured too. And Vespasian didn't know what to do with him. You can go read it. It's a fantastic read. He doesn't know what to do with him, Vespasian, because he's a worthy person. He's a noble. He's nobility. Nobility never knew what to do with other nobility. So Vespasian says, you know what? Don't worry. You're going to become emperor. I predict. Keep me alive, and let's see if my prediction is correct. Clever. Very clever. But also, he was right. He goes to Jerusalem with him. He plays the traitor. It doesn't make a difference. The rest is history. No, but it doesn't really make a difference. What makes a difference is he was also born out to be true. So that's one person who was predicting it. You have to understand, Vespasian is in the east. Eretz Yisrael is considered the east. The Romans, along with everybody else, thought the east was full of miracles, miraculous, portents and dreams and different things. You have to understand the east was always seen as it really still is today. Take a look at lots of people running to India for inspiration, I guess. It still is seen as a place of mystery. Whether it is or not, I don't know. I've never been there, and I'm not that interested. But I think you have to find mystery in your own living room, but that's me. But anyways, they certainly thought that the East was really something. Number two, many writers who wrote about this emperor, Vespasian, a writer by the name of Suetonius, famous writer, wrote on 12 Caesars, and I quoted from you something. In Judea, upon his consulting the oracle of divinity at Carmel, the answer was so encouraging that he was going to become emperor as to assure him of success in anything he projected, however great or important it might be. In Hara Carmel over there, Suetonius writes about all these portents and things that everyone's predicting Vespasian's going to be it. And there were lots of other miracles in number three. For instance, I don't get it, but anyway, this they consider important. A cypress tree in a field belonging to the family was torn up by the roots and laid flat upon the ground when there was no violent wind, but the next day it rose again fresher and stronger than before. Okay, go figure. That's Vespasian. That's according to them. That's where Suetonius wrote about this. That is a portent claiming. Doesn't matter. We get it. We don't get it. I put in a little cypress tree in my images here. But whatever. That's called a cypress tree. Okay, whatever. But the fact is that is a portent. That is one of their important elements in knowing that he is going to be victorious. Number four, Vespasian has a dream. Okay. And he thought he saw Nero, the emperor at the time, that his tooth was going to be drawn. And on that very day, the next day, a tooth came out of Nero and they showed it to Vespasian. Wonderful. Vespasian could see the future. I don't really get it. I'm not so excited by it, but whatever. That's the kind of things that were going on in the emperor. And the last one you can read for yourself. But all these kinds of things were swirling around the whole empire. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai also was one of them. And he also knew it. And that's what's amazing. To me, without these kind of slow plodding, I understand, historical investigations, you don't comprehend the genius of that story. And today, such a day of history. It's such a complicated story. It's so amazing. It's like, reminds me when my kids came, they're eating a Laffy Taffy. Oh, you like this joke? It's right up your alley. Listen to this. What's a snake's favorite subject? History. So I was thinking about that joke, history and the snake. And really, it's true. History just hisses a little bit. It gives you a little dip into something. And then you have to put a whole picture together. That's why it's fun. But that's why it's so difficult. And for the snake, with his favorite subject, I wouldn't want to want a snake in my class. Well, maybe a couple of my students were, but I don't know. But anyways, the whole thing is, it's not clear. It's not easy. You don't know what's going on. I believe if you read the story just without all of this, it would seem odd. Okay, talks about Yavne, talks about the greatness of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, talks about the ruthlessness of the Jews in the city, but that's not it. It's all this and more. So today what I wanted to do was to help you recover that story, to help you recover its beauty, and to help you really see that there's so much going on, more than anybody would know. This is just the tip of the iceberg. We could go over every line and see that it's accurate. Some scholars today feel it's not an accurate story, but I think with everything behind it, and I think with the little bits that I've shown you, I think you can feel secure that this is a historical story like anything else, and we should be proud of that.